Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast. And today we are going to be talking about Sejanus by Ben Jonson, as well as the work of a specific company around the world with a specific person. And I'm going to ask the specific person to talk about the specific company, about this specific play. My wonderful guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Hello, my name is Nathan Winkelstein. Purpose in life is a tricky question. I'm not sure we've got enough time for it. But I am the producing director of Red Bull Theater, not related to the energy drink, in New York City. And we are a theater company that focuses on reimagining classics with a particular focus on the Jacobean era.
You've done a lot of work over the years. You've done a lot of productions. Before we get to Sejanus, can you give an overview of the sort of the breadth of the kind of shows that you've worked on and the ways that you work on these plays?
Absolutely. So our model is frankly completely absurd. And by that I mean there is truly no way to do large cast, full production value productions of these plays, these lesser known plays, without losing your shirt. But luckily, because New York City is such a large ecosystem of theater, there is a significant demand for these types of plays, often from people who perhaps do know Shakespeare's canon quite well and are interested in plays of that type that they haven't heard of or seen before, and that can surprise them in new and exciting ways. And so what that means for us is that our core mission has had us doing plays like The Revenger's Tragedy, Edward II, Women Beware Women, The Duchess of Malfi. All of these are plays that I'm sure your audiences are very familiar with, and they go on and on, right? Volpone, Witch of Edmonton, She's Pity, She's a Whore, The Changeling. These are all these core Jacobean plays. And then on top of that, we do flirt with different types of adaptations of classics. So, for example, we most recently did a production of Imaginary Invalid, that the Molière play that was newly adapted by Jeffrey Hatcher. We did a hip-hop version of Medea, a Euripides play. So that's really where we're at. We try to be full cast, full company. Now, of course, we do cuts, but we try to be sort of baby Broadway in that way. It doesn't tend to be a bunch of people taking hats out of a box. It tends to be fully produced in that.
So you've got coming up, we've already mentioned Sejanus. You've also got A Roaring Girl coming up as well. And that a little bit of an adaptive element going on there. Before we get to the meat of what we're going to talk about. Do you want to briefly talk about The Roaring Girl?
Yeah, so The Roaring Girl and Sejanus are part of our Revelation reading series, which is a reading series that we use to explore these types of plays and explore new adaptations of these plays as part of a process of learning about that work. And The Roaring Girl is a play that has interested us as a company for quite a number of years. It deals with a lot of contemporary themes that are of interest to us today in terms of non-binary feminism and this exploration of what is power, what is freedom, what is happiness that feels extremely contemporary. The script itself has some flaws, especially mm-hmm. in the dramaturgical setting.
Yes. For the listeners at home, I think it's fair to say it's not the tidiest of plays in the universe. It nominally has a plot, and every so often it will remind you that there is a plot going on somewhere, and then it resolves the plot, and you sort of go, did we need the plot?
Yes, that's exactly right. And the answer to that question is, yes, you need plot. With contemporary audiences, we anticipate plot. We have a different set of expectations than the audiences of those days do. And so there are a lot of these plays, like The Roaring Girl, that sit in this pocket where they have this really, really great subject matter. They actually have all of the hard parts done. They have really interesting characters doing really well-written speeches, reaching heights that only this type of verse language can reach. And it needs to be, the infrastructure around it needs to be picked up and fixed and made to just work a little bit better from the modern era, just like you might modernize a classic home. Right. You want to keep the facade, you want to keep the structure and the bones, but you might need to bring it up to code. And so we will often do either strong edits, or we will in fact hire playwrights to do adaptations to bring these plays up to the 2026 now code.
Yes, at time of recording and maybe at time of listening, but you may be listening into the far and distant future where this That's is true. All a wonderful distant memory. From one dramaturgical problem to challenge to another, in the sense that you're doing Sejanus next. That's coming up very soon after this podcast drops. And Ben Jonson is a very different challenge in that it is structurally quite sound, but there's a lot of words. And the question, with a few exceptions of pretty much every Jonson play, is always, so how are you cutting it?
Well, and that is the question, right? He's extremely stentorian. He likes to hear himself. He likes to see his words spoken. And he has a little bit of a tendency, like many playwrights and many artists, we have a little bit of a tendency to want to tell people what we're doing instead of actually trusting that what we're doing will show them. And so for me, I've been the director on the Sejanus project for quite a while. I was attracted to the project 10 years ago. And was stunned that it had never been produced, even as a reading, in the history of the United States. And I was very attracted to the core story of the piece. Now, you have to go hunting for the core story of the piece, because uncut, it runs about 4.5 hours and I think has over 50 individual speaking characters. Which is the reason it got booed off stage in 1603 when it was first produced.
Yes, but also, to be fair, it's not the same script, because Ben Jonson decides later on that he's going to write out his collaborator. So anyone looking for that exciting George Chapman action, maybe we dodged a bullet here, guys, it will be disappointed, because, as I say, Jonson has taken it away and done his thing with it. So there's interesting questions about actually how big a text it was, you know, originally, because the version we've got has gone through a process that has made it closer to literature than drama.
Yes, he went back and edited it afterwards and we can assume, given how long it is, added quite a bit of text while also excising his partner. So the job of editing this piece that almost was rewritten for its literary value, editing it back to a productionable script has been a 10-year process. And the main reason that I went about doing it was that I found that the political conversation that was happening in this play is of particular resonance to the current political situation that is happening in my country, in the United States. And without getting too political here, there is what sets Sejanus apart is it is a pretty deep exploration of how corruption sneaks into a republic, and that it comes through cronyism and through the selling of influence. It comes through power brokers and cronyism and politicians being more interested in buying influence than in protecting their nation. And that particular look, which I think Jonson is quite insightful about in this play, is one that I was intrigued by in 2016 for a reason. And the play also, spoiler alert, the play ends with the number two in power in the Roman Empire being ripped apart by a mob. And the last time that we did a reading of this, we did one online in 2022, 2 weeks after a mob tried to rip apart the number two in power in my nation. And so the resonance has unfortunately not gone away. It has become clearer. And I have continued to be interested in this play because of that. And now with about 50% of the play cut and about 60% of the characters cut, I have a version that I think is dramatically sound.
This is a general thing about Johnson. Is the great thing about Johnson is there is too much material, because actually you can choose and craft your own adventure. In many ways, this is a much more straightforward text than, say, if you're trying to do Every Man Out of His Humour, which is a totally different kind of editorial job of work. Just on that question of resonance, Rome has always been a touchstone for these political questions. And other Roman plays of the period, as an earlier play, which we similarly were reading a Roman play at that particular juncture those years ago, The Wounds of Civil War, which similarly has weapons in the legislature. And it's when a play from hundreds of years ago suddenly leaps out and grabs you and says, yep, these things are all still here and still going on. And that's why they were writing about them 400 years ago, why they were writing about them in the aftermath of when all of these things were happening thousands of years ago, and that they can serve a function of sharpening our eyes to what's going on around us. And in a way that is not prescriptive. I mean, I'm sure Ben Johnson was quite prescriptive, but actually yes. We as artists can be there to say, we're framing how politics functions and where it can go.
Yeah, I deeply agree with that. I would also say, in its own way, to spin it slightly more optimistically, is it can feel, and it's a term that we all hear a lot right now, it can feel like we are living in unprecedented times. And I actually think there's a strange comfort in recognizing that that's not true. We are living in precedented times.
Yeah.
That this type of corruption has come for governance before. It happens quite often. Sometimes it is successful, sometimes it is defeated, and mankind moves forward. And hopefully we can learn from past instances to try to make the medicine a little bit more effective this time around. But I see it in that more optimistic light of, they were able to handle this, which is actually a more extreme version than what is happening right now. So hopefully we can handle what's going on right now. That speaks, in my opinion, to something that I feel strongly about in all the art that I do, and I think that classical theater does well, which is, I don't think that theater people's superpower is our intelligence. I think many of us are very smart, but I don't think it is what separates us. I think that theater people's superpower is empathy, and is our ability to put ourselves and our minds and our hearts into other people's shoes and learn from that. And that can mean learning how easy it is to be a bad person, how easy it is to sell what you think is a few gold crowns or, say, 30 silver pieces, and in fact what you're doing is selling your soul. And what those sort of slippery slopes are like. And I think we often do a bad job in terms of how we make monsters of the people who either think differently than us or behave poorly, rather than recognizing, no, they're very much human, which both should mean we have sympathy for them, and we should recognize that the mistakes they're making are mistakes we could make if we're not careful with ourselves.
Yes. And obviously, I think we'll come to the central figures in a moment, but I'm actually just sort of, and this may be something that has changed in your editing process, but I'm quite interested in the peripheral figures in these political events, because it's like, who is empowering certain people to do things? And we have a lot of senators and people in the background who are shifting their allegiances, who are cheerleaders for one or purely sycophantic for different sides at different points. And actually, I remember when we were reading it in the our Zoom room, that people were going, oh, well, this is a long speech. Someone's making this terribly long speech. And I'm going, no, but it's not about the speech. It's right. About everybody else in the room watching the speech, deciding which side of the Senate they want to be standing.
That's right. Oh, you're talking about the Tiberius speech at the end.
Well, no, there are earlier instances as well. And this keeps happening of when we read a play and, initially, we're forgetting how many people are in the room and how that then changes what is going on. And also the difference between public speech and private speech. You know, is the person speaking publicly telling the truth?
Right.
Or are they spinning something? And those dynamics are something really exciting and interesting about a text like this. They say on paper looks really dull. And I think that's one of the problems Sejanus has always had, is that on paper it doesn't look exciting.
So it's because it doesn't have battles.
Yeah.
It is, but we're a nation that came up with West Wing, right? Mm. Like, we are actually theoretically open to the idea of watching people really care.
Mm.
And debate politics.
Mm.
And I think that it's the really caring part that we sometimes forget. We forget Stoppard is like this as a more contemporary play, right? Rest in peace. He's someone who understands. The only way a Stoppard play works is if these people who are fighting over a math formula care just as much about that math formula as we do about football or whatever you want to say, right? That or something more extreme. It's love, but passion. Like, it is their raison d'etre. It is their purpose for being, is this math.
Mm.
Right. And I think it's very similar in this play that if you sit and you read it and you see it as a bunch of people dryly talking about how they feel about politics, it's a boring play. But if you recognize, and I think before the last 10 years in US governance, that would have been how I would have read it. But when you recognize, no, this is the government is at risk. Our republic is at risk. The thing that we take pride in being Roman, we take pride in being American, and something about that core feature is at risk, then all of these speeches that feel intellectually dry are driven with all of the passion of someone trying to stay alive, someone trying to keep a loved one alive, because that's what they're trying to do with the republic. And that completely changes it.
I keep saying we do a lot of drama that is, I say a lot of it's not even drama, that they're called debate plays and they're all about debate. And I keep telling people they're not debates, they're arguments. You've got to care. You've got to interrupt. You've got to be trying to interrupt the other speaker because you have to have that passion. Otherwise, it doesn't work.
Yes, that's exactly right. And it's all, we are reactors, not actors. Which is a dumb trope, but has some real truth to it about how it works on stage. You're right that a speech is not a speech. A speech is someone desperately holding the table while other people try to get in there.
Mm.
And then there's the other side, which fascinates me in Sejanus, which is the behind the scenes look that you get when Tiberius and Sejanus are talking. And you get this fascinating double entendre speech where they're dancing around the issue because they know, one of them knows that the other one knows that the other one knows that the other one knows. Mm. And something that I adore, this is very nerdy of me, but something that I adore about what Ben Jonson does with that is it's the only part of the play that's written in rhyming couplets.
Mm.
So the very nature of the speech itself becomes slightly more performative, slightly more structured and more formal. And then when they go back out to talking to other people and they stop doing this odd dance, they're back to more blank verse. And that is a fascinating little exploration that Ben Jonson does of how to use the verse to give us clues about what's happening in the scene.
Yeah, we were talking, mentioned in passing that, you know, the big scene towards the end, the shift in political focus of basically deciding which side you're going to be on, and you decide to be on the winning side. And all the way through the play, there's an interesting question of how much do we, it's not even like it's, you know, care about and engage with someone like Sejanus, who is not a likable guy. And the play does deliver this interesting gut punch at the end, where it's, you know, he does die horribly. But then also you find out what happens to his family.
Yes.
And you go, okay, well, no, they're proper victims of this violence as well. And I was quite taken by the emotional response I had to that news at the end. It's like, okay, we could see what was coming. Well, we knew the story of Sejanus going in. If you know your history, it's not much of a surprise. But then actually the reality of the extended political violence goes beyond the primary actors as well. And it's a passing moment. It's a very tiny moment. It might not even have made it into your final text. But it's an interesting detail that again, we were talking about connecting, that I found very, very interesting.
It did make it in. It's Laco at the end of the play. And it made it in because I find it very interesting that Jonson and Shakespeare, they share this in common, have an extreme skepticism of the mob. Mm. That there is a mob can be, that anyone who thinks that they can weaponize the mob is in for a bit of a surprise. Mm. And that it's kind of the Men in Black quote, right? Like a person is interesting and fascinating and thoughtful. People are a whole bunch of sheep and you know it. Mm. Is kind of this, it's a very pessimistic take on populism. But I do find it an interesting warning about you might be cheering as the audience of like, hey, the bad guy got their comeuppance, though you can have a whole conversation about how good or bad Tiberius is.
Mm-hmm.
But the bad guy got their comeuppance, and then you have it flipped around on you very quickly where you go, and then they killed an innocent family in a really horrific way, especially with the daughter.
Mm.
And so you get reminded that anarchy is also not the answer.
Mm.
And I think that that's a very important warning, because I think whenever people lose the faith in the government, anarchy is a fun fantasy. Mm. It's a fun fantasy to just be like, well, let's storm the Capitol.
Mm.
Right. But the answer is that is actually the end game of the awful. It's not a healing fire. So I guess I'm an anti-revolutionary is what I'm saying. But but I do think that warning exists in the text for a reason, that we should find another way through if we can.
Yeah. So the process of going to production, what process are you going through now? Are you going to be going through over the next, at time of recording, next couple, sort of week and a half, 2 weeks, by the time you're listening to this, it will be much less. What sort of process are you going through with the cast?
So with our staged readings, we're very fortunate in the actors that we're able to get in the city. And I've been very fortunate with this cast, actually going back to one of your previous points about the side characters who do a lot of this switching back and forth. I've been very fortunate that a lot of actors seem to see in the text the same thing I do and are willing to come play in roles that are frankly too small for them. Mm. So like most directing, a huge part of it is casting.
Mm.
And I have a great cast. And then we get an incredibly limited rehearsal period before we basically put it up with music stands and chairs and some basic props and some basic sound cues and some basic light cues. And we do music standography so that we use as few music stands as possible while mm-hmm. trying to make it as dynamic as possible. We all know how these work. And then I do prep work with the actors with the largest chunks of text or the most complicated journeys in the play. I do a little bit of prep work ahead of the time with each of them, just because you don't have that time on the day to dig in. And especially with a piece like this, where so much of it is the subtle dance of conversation, that taking that time outside of rehearsal to really dig into that has been very useful, especially with Tiberius, who is in some ways motivationally the most complex character.
Mm.
And not quite as large a character as Sejanus, but motivationally complex. And so almost a Machiavelli, even though they are the emperor. Mm. It's a very interesting comparison. Sejanus thinks that they're messing with Tiberius, but Tiberius is actually messing with Sejanus, that's a very fun flip and very complicated to work through. So that's how we go about that. And then the reading that we're doing, this actually came from COVID, which I think probably during COVID you were probably also getting lots of listeners as people were looking for online material. in COVID, we developed an international audience because we were doing readings of these types of plays every 2 weeks. Mm. And because of that, we now live stream about half of our readings a year. So Sejanus is one of the ones that's live streamed. It's live streamed at the same time as the actual performance, and then it's on demand for a week after that. And that's added an interesting dynamic because you do have to be, the cameramen are amazing, but you do have to keep it in mind a little bit as you're directing that you're trying to make a shot that looks good for the stage, but also is easily capturable by one of three cameras, which is an interesting additional dance that we now do.
So I can't ask you how it all went because it hasn't happened yet. But those listening to the podcast as it drops or in the week or two afterwards will be able to catch it somewhere, wherever you are online. So if you could just tell, the links will all be in the show description, but do tell us how we can find the show.
Yeah, so you can go to redbulltheater.com and it will be talking to you there pretty clearly. You'll see mostly our advertisement for our upcoming production. But if you look at our programs, you'll see Revelation Readings and the Sejanus will be right there for you to click into. And you'll see the wonderful cast that we have. You'll probably recognize a few names from various TV shows, etc. And you will also see how to buy in-person tickets if you're a New York audience member, or online tickets if you are not.
Well, we have sadly run out of time. This is a very sort of quick snapshot podcast, but it'd be lovely to chat with you again sometime in the future, find out maybe how this one went or how your next season's upcoming seasons might be all coming together and continuing. It's always lovely to talk to someone who works actively with these texts on a regular basis. It's there aren't so many of us around at the moment. It is genuinely lovely to be able to talk to you.
Very much the same. I very much enjoy talking to anybody who shares the same passion in the field as myself.
Well, all that remains is thank my wonderful guest for being wonderful. Thank you very much and goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you for listening.